Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's Olly.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today to be speaking with Dr. Jessica Cox about her book titled Confinement, The Hidden History of Maternal Bodies in 19th Century Britain, which is really interesting because actually there's a lot happening with maternity, with maternal bodies, with infant mortality, with how society more broadly is changing if we go back to the 19th century in Britain. And this book really takes us there. All sorts of things about pregnancy, about after pregnancy, about childbirth. There's really a lot to be talking about here. So Jess, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast to tell us about your book.
Thank you for having me.
Could you please start us off by introducing yourself a little bit and explain why you decided to write this book?
Yes, happy to. So I'm an academic. I'm actually, by my background, I'm in English literature. And I wrote this book. I've worked for a long time on Victorian literature and culture, researching it, teaching it. And this book really came out partly from my academic work, but also from my own experience of becoming a mother and having children. So I have three children. The eldest is now 12, particularly after I had my third child, my youngest, which was quite a difficult birth. I really began to reflect on women's experience of childbirth in the 19th century. And I primarily teach English literature, so I was encountering it in the novel, or not really, because it's not really very visible in a novel. But I became more and more interested in women's lived experiences of childbirth. And what struck me was that there's so little work on this subject to date. There's bits and pieces, and there's certain aspects of maternity that have been looked at by scholars and historians. But the book, which I ended up writing, it seemed to me was kind of missing. So I wrote it myself. So it's a little bit of a clash of the personal and the professional, I suppose, which I know we were sort of raised as academics to kind of keep the personal out of our professional work and our research and so on. But actually, it seems to me there's been a bit of a culture change in that respect in recent years, and that increasingly academics, historians, critics are bringing themselves into their research in various ways, which is what I tried to do in many respects with this book.
Well, and all projects have to start somewhere. So why not start from something you've had personal experience with and go, hang on a second, let's investigate this, which is exactly what you've done here. So if we move from modern times, from now, right back, if we go in a time machine to the 19th century, what was it like to be a woman there thinking about things around fertility and infertility? What were the marital pressures, the medical, the cultural things that women thinking about these things were contending with?
Yeah, I mean, I'm drastically different in many respects, although, you know, I did come across sort of striking similarities with women of today as well at various points. But, you know, women were under immense pressure in various ways in the 19th century. And that was impacted not only by some of the issues you've mentioned, you know, their position of as women in a society that's still largely patriarchal, where, you know, women's rights is still in its infancy in many respects, and where women are campaigning for sort of basic legal rights, particularly within marriage. So they were contending with all of this, but there's also other issues feeding into it, such as class and social status and wealth, which then impact things like access to medical care and things like that. So they were considerable. You know, there was a dominant cultural narrative that said that women's destiny was to have children, that that was women's primary purpose. And that meant that women may often have felt like they had very little choice in whether or not they had children. That was then compounded by issues around contraception, for example. So women really had very little choice when it came to contraception. Contraception was both heavily frowned upon in many quarters, inaccessible, particularly in terms of knowledge and understanding that women may have had, and also dependent often on women's partners. And that in itself was problematic if we look at the sort of wider legal context in which women, married women, were unable to refuse to have sex with their husbands. Marital rape wasn't criminalised in the UK until 1991, which was a fact I found quite astounding. So that meant that women couldn't necessarily control if or when they became pregnant. On the flip side of that, you had women who, for whatever reason, weren't able to fall pregnant. And of course, as you can imagine, there's some demonization of in the infertile woman, who in some quarters was perceived as having failed in her biological duty or in her marital duty towards her husband to have children. So considerable pressures on multiple levels, really.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Individually and compounding. If we sort of stay on the stream of fertility rather than infertility for a moment, if a woman did fall pregnant, what was talked or not talked about for it? What were the norms in the 19th century around telling people that one was pregnant, or even sort of showing it in clothing or where you went? What were those norms like?
Yeah, this was something that was really interesting. Again, you know, it partly is dependent on status, and in this instance, it particularly dependent on marital status, because whether or not a pregnancy was perceived as being positive, good news, or in very, very negative terms, did depend partly on whether or not a woman was married. So there was obviously a huge stigma around illegitimacy, which meant that women who fell pregnant outside of marriage would often attempt to conceal their pregnancies. But even respectable, if you like, in inverted commas, married women would not necessarily openly discuss their pregnancy or draw attention to it in the way that we see today, for example, with sort of very tight maternity clothing and so on. You know, partly this was an issue of perceived decorum, but it was also partly, I think, to do with risk as well, you know, whether pregnancies would be successful or not. So the language that we see around pregnancy is often quite veiled. For example, you know, in letters and diaries that I looked at, where I knew women were pregnant at the time, I'd often find references to them as unwell, which is a kind of euphemism for the pregnancy. And that kind of language can be confusing when you're doing this kind of archival research, because the term unwell is used frequently to describe the kind of normal functions of the female body. So menstruation, for example. So you're often kind of reading between the lines to try and work out what's going on. There was, you know, a clear attempt to conceal the pregnant body, and we see that reflected in artwork from the period. So there's very, very few examples of Victorian painting which depict women who are very obviously and visibly pregnant. Queen Victoria is a good example of that. She was obviously one of the most kind of painted women of the age, but there's no examples of her where we can see that she's pregnant in the portraiture. And that reflects that sort of desire to conceal the pregnant body that similarly reflected in maternity clothing and so on.
Which is very different from what we have today. So a really interesting exploration there. I was particularly struck by both the comment you made just then, and of course you go into it in more detail in the book, about kind of the trickiness of this language, the slipperiness of it. And I can just imagine how hard it would be in the archives to be like, well, when she says unwell, what does she mean in this case? You know, is this relevant for my research or not?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, no, I could easily imagine it. And in fact, it seems to be quite a thing throughout the research for this, because it's not just around being pregnant and not showing it or talking about it that it comes up. You document kind of the number of ways, the extent to which there's so much slippery language around pregnancy, around childbirth, around kind of the immediate postpartum aspect. Of course, obviously, we might more famously know about ignorance and lack of confusing language around sex. Why was there so little information, so little discussion? Why didn't women know about these things?
I think there's a number of reasons for it. You know, one reason is that it wasn't deemed to be appropriate for women to have lots of sort of medical knowledge or anatomical knowledge and so on. So there was an issue of kind of propriety or perceived kind of decorum around these issues. But it really, you know, was. I think when I was doing the research, what I expected was I was familiar with the Victorian novel in which pregnancy and the female body are not explicitly referenced very often. But I expected in women's journals and letters to find that women would be more open with one another in private correspondence, particularly between women. And in some instances, that was the case. But even there, we'd find, you know, examples where the language is quite veiled. So, you know, Queen Victoria's daughter writing to her saying that she had hopes again, the hopes, you know, obviously referring to a pregnancy. You know, Emma Darwin repeatedly referring to herself and Charles Darwin as well to his wife as unwell. So, you know, it was interesting to me to see that was not simply a sort of affectation of the novel, if you like, or of public discourse, but that women were keen, really, in some respects, not to be explicit when discussing their bodies and their pregnancies. And sort of leading on from that was this idea of ignorance. So I think some of the obscurity around pregnancy in some cases came from the fact that women simply didn't understand their own bodies. They didn't understand necessarily that they were pregnant. And I found several examples of that, you know, including women who didn't know what was the matter with them until they were some way into the pregnancy and had to be explicitly told that this is what had happened to them. So, you know, that to me was surprising, because I'd imagined that there were perhaps a kind of oral tradition of discussing these matters that might not be captured within the literature of the period necessarily, but that nonetheless existed. And it, as I say, it wasn't necessarily the case.
Yeah, that, to be honest, that is what I had expected going into the book, that, okay, I know it doesn't come up in novels, but surely in letters, right? Mm. And so that was a really interesting finding. I'd like to ask you, you've mentioned a few times the idea of social class, obviously, having a pretty big impact on women's experiences of pregnancy. And you've given us the example already about kind of inside or outside of marriage being also an aspect of status. But we do often more frequently think of Queen Victoria, right? The posh people, the people that we more frequently have films about or have more diaries and records of. What if we go to the other end of the social spectrum? What was it like to be a pregnant woman, for example, in a workhouse?
Yeah, I was really keen to try and uncover the stories of those women in the book. As you say, we encounter the those who were kind of rich and wealthy and left behind large estates, which were helpfully filled with letters and diaries that we can access down the generations. But of course, in fact, you know, women like Queen Victoria and the aristocracy made up a tiny percentage of the population. So I really wanted to try and uncover the stories of the wider populace at the time and how they were giving birth and experiencing pregnancy and so forth. And of course, you know, the workhouse was such a kind of is such a sort of dominant institution of the period. You know, it's what we associate very clearly with kind of ideas of Victorian poverty and so on. And there were women giving birth in the workhouses, and probably more women gave birth in the workhouses than did in the kind of aristocratic homes of the country. So it was important to me to try and uncover those stories. And I really wanted to try as far as possible to uncover those stories from the women's perspective. But of course, women who are poor and often illiterate and so forth don't leave behind the same records. So that proved challenging. But there were some accounts that you come across in, for example, court records where you've got witness testimony and things like that that are particularly revealing. And as you can imagine, it was incredibly difficult to give birth in the workhouse. Again, workhouses varied. So, you know, some women may have had a more positive experience than others. But I certainly came across lots of horror stories of women's experiences, including women turning up to the workhouse in labour and being sent away and giving birth in the streets, women who were attended in the workhouse by other inmates of the workhouse rather than by medical staff, accounts of the lying in wards as being very dirty and overcrowded and so on. So, yeah, lots of very kind of distressing narratives emerging from the workhouse.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
This episode is supported by FX's Clipped, the scandalous story of the 2014 Clippers owner's racist remarks captured on tape and heard around the world. The series charts the tape's impact on a dysfunctional basketball organization striving to win against their reputation as the most cursed team in the league. Starring Lawrence Fishburne, Jackie Weaver, Cleopatra Coleman, and Ed O'Neill. FX's Clipped. Streaming June 4th. Only on Hulu.
And these differences in class don't just stop, you know, they're not just different during the period of pregnancy or even in the process of childbirth. Also, there's the kind of aspect after that. So I wonder if you can kind of continue telling us a bit about, you know, being in labor, giving birth to child, what happens in the immediate, you know, hours, days after that. What was the different experience like depending on things like social class? And was it entirely different if you were at one end of the spectrum versus the other?
I think the simple answer to that question is probably yes. It was dramatically different. And one of the really kind of noticeable differences is in terms of the expectations that were placed on women from different classes. So if you look at advice literature from the period, for example, which is primarily aimed at middle-class women, women are advised to rest for a period of 2 weeks without rising from their bedrooms, to have very limited stimulation, even insofar as reading and writing. It was interesting to me to see that women's diaries do actually pause for 2 weeks often in the period after they give birth. There was one case of a woman whose husband takes up writing her diary because women were perceived as needing this period of extended rest after they'd given birth. But of course, if you were very poor, if you had a large family already, you maybe had to go out to work soon after giving birth because there's nothing in the way of maternity benefits that we have today. Even if women were not going out to work, they often had very heavy domestic labour, which needed doing. So there was no opportunity for women on the opposite end of the social scale to indulge, if you like, in this period of extended rest. So despite the advice books, you know, speaking about this period is absolutely essential in order to protect women's health, it just simply wasn't something that was possible for many women in Victorian Britain.
What sorts of medical care were available for women across the social spectrum?
So again, it varied. And of course, with wealth came the ability to access the best medical care that was available. So Queen Victoria, for example, gave birth surrounded by various doctors who were the leading figures in their field. She had a monthly nurse to help her. She had a wet nurse following the birth of the child, as well as you know, a kind of bevy of servants and so on. She would give birth in very clean surroundings, you know, in the palace. And you contrast that with women who could not afford medical care at a time before the NHS in this country, where free medical care was extremely limited. So women might benefit from some of the lying-in charities and be able to give birth in one of the institutions, such as the lying-in hospitals. There were several in London as well as elsewhere. But they might also give birth at home. Most women did give birth at home, and they may then only be attended by a midwife, and midwives typically had very little in the way of formal training, largely because this was denied to them. So there were some very good midwives who had lots and lots of experience, but there were also midwives who were neglectful. There's a stereotype of the 19th century midwife as kind of ignorant and a drunkard and so on, and perpetuated to some extent by the novels of the time from people like Dickens and so forth. But there were good midwives, and at the end of the day, having money didn't protect women completely from the dangers of childbirth. So there were limitations in medical knowledge, particularly in understanding, for example, around the spread of infection, which could put women at risk regardless of their social status. So there's some variation, but broadly speaking, women at the poorer end of the social scale inevitably gave birth in more difficult conditions than those with more money.
Hmm. Not hugely surprising, but I suppose a bit sad to hear nonetheless, as important as it is to understand. Moving to another aspect of the many kind of questions and aspects of issues of pregnancy, if we go back to the point you mentioned about about marital status being such a huge aspect of this, obviously social class as well, but marital status too. If one found oneself pregnant outside of marriage, kind of regardless of where on the social ranking you might be, was abortion an option? What was the legal status of it at this point? What was the public discourse around it? Was it an option?
Well, the short answer is yes, it was an option, but no, it wasn't legal. So it remained illegal throughout the period and obviously into the 20th century. And I'm sure you're aware that we still have some Victorian legislation on the books today. There was a case last year which kind of drew public attention to this. So it was criminalised, but it was nonetheless, from what we can tell, reasonably widely practised. I think particularly so because in some respects it was easier to end a pregnancy than it was to prevent a pregnancy. So, you know, abortion was potentially an easier option than contraception. It's difficult, obviously, with an activity which is illegal throughout the period to give accurate estimates of how many women underwent abortions. But you can see from the criminal records, the criminal cases, for example, that it was clearly very commonly practiced, and you find comments to that end in various criminal cases. A number of medical professionals, doctors and midwives, worked as abortionists, you know, and in some cases that was in order to try and help women who found themselves in impossible situations. So it was obviously very risky. It often could lead to infection, and there's numerous cases of women dying as a consequence of illegal abortions. But it was something that was an option for women, certainly. And I think as well, the public discourse around abortion at the time, which was, as you can imagine, very, very critical of the idea, you know, often cited religious beliefs, for example, often, you know, demonized women who would undergo this kind of procedure. Those public discourses do differ, I think, from women's private experiences. And there's very few examples of women speaking openly about abortion that I found. But there was one particular example which came from a woman called Lady Henrietta Stanley, who essentially terminated her own pregnancy. It was her 12th pregnancy, I believe. And she wrote to her husband, who had been sort of outraged by the fact that she'd managed to fall pregnant again, didn't seem to take much responsibility for it himself, and said, you know, a long ride and a heavy dose have done the trick. And she's very practical, very kind of down to earth. There's no kind of moralizing. There's no questioning of herself or her actions. She seems to perceive it as a sort of necessary practical step to deal with an unwanted pregnancy when she already has a large number of children.
I mean, 12th pregnancy, that is quite something. Yeah, so clearly she's used to thinking about it in lots of respects already. One thing you've mentioned a little bit that I'd love to discuss further is the profession of midwifery, which is undergoing some interesting changes over the course of the 19th century. I wonder if you can tell us a bit about this.
Yeah, absolutely. So as I said, for most of the period, most midwives didn't have any formal qualification and they didn't have any access to any training. And of course, that reflects a wider issue in the 19th century where women were denied access to medical education because, again, it was deemed as being inappropriate, and particularly anything that had anything to do with anatomy was seen to be sort of unseemly. So midwives prior to the 19th century obviously had been assisting women in childbirth for hundreds of years. And prior to the sort of mid 18th century, childbirth wasn't particularly medicalized. So it was seen as the kind of remit of the midwife to be in the room with women. It was seen as something that was female centered, the process of giving birth, not only the mother herself, but those around her as well. And it's only really in the mid 18th century, as I say, that we see this shift towards the kind of medicalization of childbirth. And gradually, as we go into the 19th century, it really becomes the domain of the medical man. And so there's really a fairly kind of successful campaign, I would say, to demonize the figure of the midwife and for the medical men to then be able to kind of monetize childbirth. And of course, you get this sort of tension between midwives and medical men in terms of how they're help assisting women, the training that they have, the knowledge that they have, and so on. But towards the end of the century, there's a significant campaign for midwives to be able to access training. And that really comes to fruition as the century closes with the passing of the Midwives Act, and women are able then to be formally qualified as midwives for the first time. And those that have been practicing as midwives for a long time are able to gain recognition for their experience as well at this point. So there is a huge shift in that respect, not quite back towards midwife-led care, but a recognition that the midwife is providing an important service for women in childbirth.
Yeah, no, that is very much a big change. One thing we've talked about in multiple aspects that I kind of want to kind of bring together, I suppose, is how women discuss this and process it. Because a lot of the things you've told us about are obviously not just momentous, but in many cases, quite traumatic around pregnancy, around labor, around medical care, around what happens after. I mean, we haven't even really talked that much about stillbirths or miscarriages, but how did women talk about or process these things?
That's a really interesting question. I came across some evidence clearly of women who were traumatized by their experiences of pregnancy and childbirth, often as a consequence of some of the things you mentioned. So, you know, a miscarriage or stillbirth, or particularly difficult deliveries and instrumental deliveries. So there's no doubt that childbirth could be extremely traumatic in the 19th century. But of course, there's no real recognition, certainly not of what we would now identify as postnatal PTSD at this time. So there's a sort of to some extent, I think women, there's an expectation that they will cope, that they will manage. There's some exceptions in the recognition of an association between traumatic deliveries, for example, and puerperal mania, which we find in some of the kind of case notes around mental institutions and so forth. But broadly speaking, you know, the process of giving birth was something that women were seen as born to do, as I said, so that the expectation is that they kind of just get on with it. But the relatively high compared to today, infant mortality rates, stillbirth rates, miscarriage rates, maternal mortality rates, meant that it could be an extremely traumatic experience. And the instrumental deliveries, firstly at a time before much was understood about the spread of infection, certainly prior to the mid-19th century, where there was little in the way of effective pain relief, again, could be extremely traumatic. And some of the procedures that we're familiar with today, such as cesareans, were very rarely performed because of the risk that they posed to the life of the mother. And so the alternative to the cesarean section in cases of difficult delivery was often craniotomies or embryotomies, with destructive operations that would destroy the child, because there was a general belief that the life of the mother should be preserved over and above the child. The mother could go on to have more children. whereas the child still had to kind of make its way through the dangerous years of early infancy. And of course, those experiences could be extremely traumatic for women.
And so did they talk about them, either in letters or novels or actually out loud, or was it all hidden?
So certainly not in novels. We see very little in the way of any reference to childbirth, let alone difficult deliveries. Of course, you do, you know, have the sort of references to women dying in childbirth, but they're usually kind of dispatched in a single sentence with no information about the kind of grisly details in the novel, at least. Some references in private letters that talk about particularly obviously the trauma of child loss, very moving references. And I think I was guilty to some extent of thinking that the frequency of early mortality, early infant mortality, perhaps lessened its impact, and that women perhaps were familiar with loss in a way that we are not today, that perhaps rendered it a little, you know, easier to bear. But it's very clear from some of the letters and journals that I looked at that that wasn't necessarily the case. And there are countless examples of women who are deeply traumatized by the loss of their children. Mary Shelley, for example, talks very, very movingly about the loss of her child who was born prematurely, imagines that the child is still, dreams that the child is still awake and still alive and so forth. Elizabeth Gaskell writes a sonnet to her stillborn child some years after, which suggests that she was very affected by its death. So you do find references to certainly maternal grief, perhaps less so to some of the kind of physical trauma that women may have experienced. But there is certainly some references in medical case notes which make clear the extent to which women's bodies were really damaged by childbirth and particularly by instrumental deliveries, and occasionally references from women themselves talking about how difficult they found childbirth.
Mm. What if we move after childbirth? What were some of the complexities, challenges depending on social status, around what you did after that, particularly in terms of feeding these newly born children?
Yes, so the debates around infant feeding were really interesting for various reasons. Again, you know, partly because all of these issues around social status feed into it as well. Also because of the sort of resonances that we see with today, where it remains this, you know, it's a very contentious issue that the breast is best versus fed is best. It's a subject which women struggle with when they become new mothers. You know, the pressure to breastfeed, in some cases, the desire to breastfeed and the inability to do so for whatever reason. And I could see the sort of resonance, you know, I could see the echoes of these parallels with today's debates in some of the 19th century debates. But of course, in some respects, the stakes were much higher. So advice literature typically advises women to breastfeed as the healthiest option for their children. The difference with today is that so-called artificial feeding or hand feeding, where babies were spoon-fed or bottle-fed, was much, much riskier in the 19th century than it is today. Again, partly to do with a lack of understanding about the spread of germs and bacteria. So a lack of cleaning of feeding equipment, but also things like the contamination of milk potentially, or the contamination of foodstuffs, which could make babies very, very ill. So those who were bottle-fed or spoon-fed, there were really, really significantly higher mortality rates amongst those children. And this is part of the reason why there was so much pressure on women to breastfeed. But of course, there was this third alternative as well, which was to hire a wet nurse to feed your child for you. And that was something that remained relatively common practice throughout the period. I mean, it was particularly amongst the aristocracy, and Queen Victoria was a really interesting example of this, because she was absolutely sort of horrified by the prospect of breastfeeding her own children, partly because she saw it as a kind of animal-like function, and she felt that she was too refined as a gentlewoman to feed her children. So she hired wet nurses to feed all nine of her children. But two of her daughters at least chose to breastfeed their own children. And Victoria was fairly horrified by this, and rumour has it named a cow in the royal dairy after one of her daughters when she found out she was breastfeeding herself. So there's, again, these sort of class issues which feed into it. The issue of wet nursing, you know, raised a whole load of other questions, because particularly for the aristocracy, women like Queen Victoria, in order to perform the duties of a wet nurse, you obviously had to have given birth yourself in order to be producing breast milk. So there's lots of questions about what happens to the children of wet nurses, and at various points, sort of moral panics around the idea that women are deliberately falling pregnant, sometimes outside of marriage, so that they can obtain work as wet nurses, and either leaving their own children to the care of the infamous baby farmers, or even dispatching of the babies themselves. So yeah, a whole range of interesting issues around that question of infant feeding, for sure.
And some aspects of that answer are just like, that doesn't have anything to do with today. And yet other aspects are like, wait a second, those debates are happening pretty much exactly the same way now, which is such an interesting combination to see on just one of the issues in the book. And in fact, is what I'd like to kind of ask you about as we zoom out and look at the book overall. What to you were some of the clearest continuities you found between what you discovered in the 19th century and what it's like today?
Yeah, absolutely. As you say, sort of stark differences and then really quite striking similarities as well. So the infant feeding debates, you know, as I say, there were very kind of clear resonances there. But around other issues as well, you know, the pressure that women are under to behave in particular ways, the sort of influx of advice. So, you know, there was a real explosion of advice literature in the 19th century, and women were being told, you know, what they should eat, what they should do, you know, when they should rest, or, you know, huge amount of information to take on board, some of it contradictory, some of it probably good advice, and some of it absolutely not good advice. So taking cocaine for toothache, for example, during pregnancy. But there was an echo here for sure, or, you know, it anticipates the kind of overwhelming amount of information that I think pregnant women face today, particularly in the online world, of course. You know, this attempt in some respects to police women's bodies is still something I think that's with us today. The idea that women are somehow responsible for the outcome of their pregnancy is a narrative that we haven't fully escaped from, I don't think. And then, of course, there's things like the guilt and the taboo even around issues such as miscarriage and stillbirth. And infertility as well, you know, the things that it's still not easy to discuss, that are still perhaps not discussed in public discourses in the way that they should be. I think that has begun to shift in recent years. But nonetheless, I think there's echoes of the 19th century there. And then more recently, of course, with the retrograde move to restrict women's reproductive rights at various parts of the globe, including in America, you know, highlight the fact that to some extent, I think we're still living under the shadow of Victorian attitudes towards women's bodies and pregnancies, particularly around that, you know, the issue of abortion. As I mentioned, the case of Carla Foster last year, who was tried for late-term abortion, that prosecution happened under Victorian legislation that's still on the statute books. So clearly there are things that haven't changed, I think, in many respects, as well as kind of huge differences with what women experience during pregnancy and childbirth then.
Which highlights in many ways the importance of the book. So thank you for giving us that big picture answer to kind of round out our discussion on it, leaving me with just my final question. What might you be currently working on or looking to work on since this book has been finished, even if it's not on this topic, even if it's not a book? Is there anything you'd like to highlight?
Well, I mean, apart from my academic admin, which obviously takes up most of my time, I'm still looking into this issue of women's maternal experiences. I've done a little bit more work since I finished the book, particularly around the issue of abortion, partly because, it seems to resonate so much with some of the things that are happening today and some of the debates that are still taking place. And I'm also still working in the archives to try and uncover women's personal narratives, because for me, that was the most important part of the book, was to find these stories of women's experiences in their own words. And that involved a certain amount of sort of serendipitous research, because that kind of material is not necessarily well indexed, and it's often sort of passing references that are made to the maternal body in archival letters and diaries and so forth. So I'm doing a little bit more work looking at how we can do more to kind of uncover these stories as well.
Well, best of luck as you continue those excavations. And of course, listeners can read the book we've been discussing, titled Confinement, The Hidden History of Maternal Bodies in 19th Century Britain. Jess, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.